mandate and function. But on our side, working with DPME, we also get an opportunity to give input into the planning documents of departments. So just like they submit the first draft strategic plan and APP to DPME, they would submit a copy to Treasury. We also make our own input into that. And one of the things we make inputs on is the technical indicator descriptions, because I agree with you completely that the technical indicator descriptions are very important in terms of analyzing the performance information that's in the APP. So it is an annexure to the annual performance plan. Unfortunately, in most instances, when the department, you know, tables its APP, just tables the APP and not the annexure. Even when they submit the APP for comments to DPME and Treasury, they would submit the APP and not the technical indicator descriptions. But what we've done in previous instances, even in the last planning cycle, is that part of our role is to not just comment on the planning documents, but we get invited into the planning sessions for departments where we give inputs on what we think about the performance. I've said, for example, with the civilian secretariat to assist them specifically on the technical indicator description. For staffs, we didn't get an opportunity to see the technical indicator descriptions for this 2017-18 APP that was tabled as well. But in terms of follow-up on that, it would be done through DPME. But I agree with you, it is important to have a look at those as well. And then you also asked the question around reprioritization of funds to Home Affairs and why IPID was not given money for the Falun Commission of Inquiry recommendations. The reprioritization of funds for the advanced passenger processing was an agreement that was reached between the two departments. From a Home Affairs point of view, previously Home Affairs, from a budget process point of view, was not part of the function, that is Defence, Public Order and Safety. For the first time last year, they were part of the function. So when I was talking earlier about some of the functional approach enabling us to discuss cross-cutting issue, there was a discussion on the advanced passenger processing system. It's obviously a system that SAPS benefits from in terms of doing its work. So when Home Affairs indicated its funding challenges in that area, because SAPS benefits from it, then there was an agreement between the two accounting officers of the department to say that SAPS can prioritize some money from the CJS towards that. The issue why IPID was not given money for Falun Commission, I think as part of the resource considerations that I highlighted, is the issue of a department's capacity to be able to spend money that was allocated. At the time that we were talking about, you know, 5 million for IPID in relation to Falun, I think until the last two financial years, IPID has had issues with spending the money that we've been allocating to them. So they've had significant underspending. So it does happen that a department comes and they want more money, but when we look at their capacity to spend, we actually find that but they're not spending what they've been allocated. So therefore, there are no justifiable reasons as to why we must allocate more. So the understanding, or what we communicated to IPID at the time, is that make use of some of the underspending that you have to push towards implementation of the Falun recommendation. So they were not given money for that. But obviously, over the last 2 years, we've seen an improvement in spending in IPID. But for us also, when we are looking at spending, it's not just saying, okay, the department has spent its money, all of it tick, but we also look at what some of the areas that the department has spent its money on. And with IPID, there are instances where we've raised concern with them to say, but you are spending too much on this and it's not part of your core. So that was the reason why there was no money allocated to IPID, because at the time that we were talking about this, they were actually having underspending and they were requested to reprioritize from the underspending to provide money for the implementation of the Falun Commission recommendation. There was also a question from Honorable Molebatsi about how can we address the fact that there's no one-on-one link between budget and expenditure in SAPS. I think in relation to that, as I highlighted in the presentation, performance management became a key feature in the budget process around 2008. So because our budgeting essentially is incremental, so there was already money that we were allocating to departments. But what we've tried to do since the introduction of performance management in the budgeting is that for every additional additional resources that we give to a department, we always ask a department to justify to us how is that going to improve spending. So if you are saying, you're coming to Treasury, you're saying, I need 5 million to implement the Falam Commission recommendations, you then have to provide as part of the evidence or as part of your budget submission, what is the impact that the 5 million is going to have on your performance. So it's something that we've really hammered with departments since then. Every time that we allocate money, there must be a demonstration of how that is going to have an impact on performance. We are obviously still not, I think, cracking it 100% at this point in time. Hence, we are still saying that there's no alignment between the two. But it's something that we are constantly working on, even with DPME, to try and make sure that at some point we must be able to see scientifically, especially, what the impact is every time we add more resources to a department, so that we can then try and strengthen that relationship between performance and the budget. It is a bit difficult in the subspace, given that the bulk of the resources go towards compensation of employees, and the same person that can be a visible policing officer today can also be deployed to crime intelligence, for example, if needs be. So then it even causes, I think, more complication in that regard, because this is a highly labor intensive environment. And then there was also the question around SAPS approaching National Treasury for funding. I wanted to explain there that in year, when a department comes to us for additional funding, in terms of, you know, budget regulations and the Public Finance Management Act and Treasury regulations, there are only very few instances in which Treasury can provide, or Cabinet, I should say, can, you know, approve money for allocation to a department in year. And those are prescribed. For example, it talks about issues of rollover, issues when there's unforeseeable and unavoidable expenditure. If I look at the last 5 years, we've actually not provided money to SAPS except for compensation of employees. As I highlighted in one of the slides, the growth in the compensation of employees because of the labor agreement has been quite high, and we've had to augment the budget, not only of SAPS, but of other departments, to try and make sure that they are able to pay and sustain the salary. So the only money we've provided to SAPS has been for that purpose. There was also money that we provided, about 583 million, and it was specifically for the implementation of the Falam Commission of Inquiry recommendation. But other than that, we have not really provided any other money to SAPS. And part of the reason has also been the constrained fiscal environment that I was talking about. They have come to us with a number of policy priorities, but the discussions we've been having with them during the budget process is to say that, but we've helped them identify money within the baseline to fund some of these things, sometimes removing money. There were instances where we had to reduce the budget for transport equipment, as I indicated, which is high, to reprioritize to some of the policy priorities. But we've not really provided any additional funding to SAPS other than to augment the compensation of employees, as I've indicated. And then the questions from Honorable Mulla on, I think, the slide 14, CJS 7-point plan. What if the department doesn't submit? What do we do? So as part of the allocation letters we give to departments on an annual basis, we also set conditions on certain budget amounts that we've earmarked. The implementation of the 7-point plan budget amounts we've also earmarked, and we've attached conditions to that. One of the conditions we've attached is to say to the department they must submit the plan to us before the beginning of the financial year. But we also say, as part of the conditions, if they don't submit the plan to us before the beginning of the financial year, then they can't spend the allocation that they've been allocated. So they know that they must submit to us before they can actually spend. We've received their plans for 2017-18, for example, and we're just finalizing our feedback. We gave them feedback. There were things we were concerned about. They had to address them, and then they've come back to us. So it is more like a conditional allocation we make to make. There are certain conditions that they must meet before they can actually spend. So that's how we are managing the issue of the submission of the plan. And then there was the issue around detective services. Targets are low. but they don't achieve. What do we do about that? When it comes to the performance side, obviously the DPME-led process, but like I indicated, on our side, we don't just simply look at the finances, we also look at the performance, and we've had engagement. So when we're talking about reprioritizing resources to allocate and prioritize to certain things, those are some of the things that we look at to say, but should your budget for, you know, detective services, for example, be this amount given that you are not able to achieve your target? But the main question I think we've asked to the department, because on a number of times we've made presentations in their planning session, is to say, is the target for detective services, you know, correct? Are we not setting the targets too low, or are they not too high given what the department can practically achieve? So it's part of those ongoing conversations that we have with departments around such issues. And there were instances where, for some of the indicators, they've had to revise them because we raised questions as Treasury about the practicality of them achieving those targets. So we would ask them those questions and get them to amend the indicators at some point. I think also from an oversight point of view, maybe the committee, as it engages the department, these are some of the issues that can also be highlighted with the department. And I think a number of honourable members raised the issue around, you know, the 76% on compensation of employees. Is it too much? Is it too little? On our side, because we are obviously not policing experts, but we try to empower ourselves and understand the environment. So we've not questioned the 76% per se, but we've been constantly engaging the department to say, given what your priorities are, given the mandate, given, you know, the key issues for the department, does it make sense, you know, to have 76% of the budget going towards compensation? If you engage the department, they will even tell you that the 76% could be more, but they had taken an executive decision as a department to not try and exceed, you know, the 77%. Policing is obviously a labor-intensive environment and function to perform. Hence, there are a number of people that the department appoints. The bulk goes to this. But as to whether or not, you know, what is the right ratio, I think the department would be best placed to give more guidance on that. But on our side, we've engaged the department on this particular issue as well. So even when we're talking about the compensation of employees leaving, at some point is also going to force the department to rethink the split of its budget, because you do find in some instances that they cannot, they might not be able to afford the number of people they have at this point in time, and they might have to restructure the budget to kind of reprioritize resources in other environments as well. And then in relation to the questions from Honourable Ntlangu, I think there was the issue around the lack of a control tool, or what yardstick do we use? Are we getting info from SAPS on what the department is using? So this is part of this ongoing conversation we are having with the department. We've developed templates and workshops the department. Sometimes we do templates and we send to the department to say, can you complete your information in this particular format? Because we're trying to get them to start thinking about their budget in this particular manner. But the challenge when it comes to SAPS will always be the fact that because some of the things that the department reports on are not necessarily things that are within its control, it will always be a bit of a challenge for them to have this one-on-one link between the two, because some of their indicators are actually impact indicators. So a department has to do certain things, implement certain initiatives and projects, and then the impact of that will be a reduction in the number of crime. But because it's the indicator for the department, when they budget, they won't be able to say, okay, if we put X amount of money, we can reduce crime by 1% or 5%. So that one-on-one link will always be a challenge, because a lot of these indicators are actually impact indicators and not within its direct control. there was a question to say, what is others? I think the others that you saw on the presentation when we were presenting the split in the budget is just others that we've put. It's actually us who lumped everything together because we wanted to show the key spending drivers, but you say under others, those would be other items in goods and services, your communication, your property payments, your audit fees and things like that. The spending towards those items was not significant, and that's why we lumped them together under others. But essentially, the key spending drivers would be what we indicated, your computer services, your operating leases. So it's not that the department is hiding anything under others, but it's just us as trainees who lumped together everything. And then there were concerns from Honorable Poonevold about the budget and the way that we've presented. I must apologize for slide 19 that we didn't put the rand 1,000. Sometimes if you have to fit numbers, especially in billions, in a slide, it becomes a bit messy if you show the full amount. So what we do, we put the rand 1,000. I think it's the same thing that we've done in slide 20, which is the slide that follows. We put rand 1,000 to show that you must look at the number and add three zeros, and that's what will essentially say to the reader that it's billions. So we did that in slide 20, but we omitted to do that in slide 19, and I must apologize for that. We can insert and then send a revised presentation to the committee, especially if it's to be used for other purposes as well. And then there was a question.
And slide 21.
Yes, slide 21. And then there was the question on, you know, to what sense does Treasury check the austerity measures announced by the Minister of Finance? As part of the reporting mechanisms that I presented to say that we use, we also have got Excel templates and sheets that say to departments they need to report on those things. For example, if you look at the instruction notes 2 and 3 of 2016-17 that were issued by the National Treasury coming from the Office of the Chief Procurement Officer, one of the requirements is that the department must report on a monthly basis. There's actually a reporting tool that has been sent to departments to say every month they need to report to Treasury alongside those categories to say, to what extent have we implemented austerity measures in relation to travel, to accommodation venues. So there are reporting channels that are in place to try and monitor that. But also from a public finance point of view, we do look at the monthly reports that are submitted, specifically asking questions around those issues as well. And then the question from Honorable Mbele, there was a comment around the extent to which we are making use of past evaluations, and to say, I think the question was, who is responsible for managing this process? Is that a DPME function? I wasn't clear as to whether past evaluations, we are talking about formal expenditure reviews or performance evaluations are being done, or if it's generally, because if it's expenditure reviews, then that's something that is done by Treasury, but the performance evaluations are done by DPME. But in both instances, sometimes the recommendations that are coming from DPME do not come to us in time, for example, to inform the budget for a year, and they might be delayed to the following year. So that's something that we said we need to strengthen, to also make sure that the outcomes of those evaluations are becoming a prominent feature in the budget process to inform decision-making. Even with the expenditure reviews, we are not at a point where we've fully made use of the recommendations that are flowing from that to be able to inform our budget. And there has been an internal discussion within Treasury to say that we need to make greater use of that, because there's a lot of, I think, good recommendations that are coming from those evaluations that we can use to make decisions around budget allocation in departments. And then there was the issue around the involvement of the executive authorities. I think that is probably best placed to have the department touch on it. But I had wanted to say that on our side, there's a lot of communication that we send to the executive authorities of departments through our minister. If we want to escalate certain issues of concern that we have in a department, and we think that They can best be driven by an executive authority. We do have communication that we send through our minister to the executive authorities to escalate certain issues. In some cases, we even request that there be meetings between the two to discuss those kind of issues. And then there was the issue, I think the final question was from Honorable Mabija on the perception around the allocation for Program 5. I think even with that as well, our process, our role is to guide the department and to make sure that there are justifiable reasons for allocating funds to certain programs. So as part of the engagements we have, looking at past evaluations and other information, we would take all of those things into account when we are allocating the budget, including for Program 5.
Thank you very much to the National Treasury for the input and responses. We appreciate that. We immediately will then go to SAPO. Welcome to the President, and you're welcome to introduce your delegation. I presume not the whole delegation.
No. Thank you, Honorable Chair, for this opportunity. We as the South African Policing Union take this very serious because we know it has got a direct impact. Whatever we do here has got direct impact to the members whom we serve and the societies whom we serve too. Hence we are here with the National Office Bearers, and the rest of the group that you see here are National Executive Committee members. The presentation by Treasury, very fascinating, and it was very interesting to listen to them. And hope that one day, Honorable Chair, we will have an opportunity to sit down with management during the plenary session of the budget, you know, before it reaches a stage such as this one, because I think it is very important for us to really engage with them on some of the issues which are raised here, because they are very, very crucial. What more, our principle is that where there are challenges, we raise them with the relevant authorities, and we strive to constructively engage the authorities on the issues that require their attention to elicit the necessary corrections. Honorable Chair, our submission is focused on the following. Amendment of the South African Police Service Act 68 of 1995, Police Act, compliance with the Regulation 8 of the South African Police Service Regulation 1964, in bracket police regulations regarding ranks in the subs.
Sorry, President, for that. Apparently, the presentation was sent this morning, so there's a bit of a problem with printing it, but we will ensure that members get a copy, so it's really made available, but you're welcome to go ahead.
And we're sorry about this, Honorable Members. I can see now the guns are drilled.
But it's on the screen.
Thank you. The implementation of the National Development Plan, Vision 2030, and filling of critical vacant and funded posts, corruption cases against the members of the SAPS, and the TPCR issues. On the amendment of the South African Police Service Act, for some time there has been submissions to this August House that the Police Act is wanting because it precedes the Constitution. Promises have been tabled before this House to overrule the Act, but were not fulfilled. We are aware that at some stage, task teams were put in place by the SAPS to review the law, but was interrupted and did not complete its assignment. The Act has been amended in the piecemeal fashion on specific sections. We are not in any better position today. Our view is that the Act should be revisited in its entirety, and not only visit it when the lacuna has already caused some damage. One of the provisions that needs to be corrected is the appointment of the National Commissioner, both in an acting and permanent capacity. May I emphasize that the gap was diagnosed by the National Planning Commission, which inserted it in Chapter 12 of the NDP. It is regrettable that since the adoption of the NDP in September 2012, nothing tangible has been done to correct the law. The NDP remains nothing more than a mere plan. We call on the new leadership to see this commitment through. It can no longer be an excuse to argue that the act precedes our constitution. As a lawmaker, the power is invested in your hands. May we use this opportunity to commend the current minister who, in correcting anomaly regarding the national head of the DPCI, observed the provisions of section 17CA in bracket 12 in bracket A of the Police Act. This section provides as follows, and I quote, whenever the national head of the directorate is absent or unable to perform his or her functions, the minister shall appoint the deputy national head of the directorate as the acting national head of the directorate. Close quote. It is worth recalling that section 6 in brackets 4 of the IPED Act 1 of 2011 provides an equally effective which reads, and I quote, in bracket 4, when the executive director is unable to perform the functions of office or during a vacancy in the directorate, the minister may designate another person to act as an executive director until the executive director attains to perform the functions of office or the vacancy is filled, close quote. Unfortunately, the Police Act is silent about the appointment of the Acting National Commissioner. Section 6.1 of the Police Act provides that, and I quote, there shall be a National Commissioner of the Service who shall be appointed in accordance with Section 207 and Bracket 1 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1996. Section 7.1 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, 1996, provides that, and I quote, the President, as head of the National Executive, must appoint a woman or a man as the National Commissioner of the Police Service to control and manage the police, close quote. However, this power is to be exercised, it's not specified, to overcome the challenge created by this silence. Chapter 12 of the NDP recommends as follows, and I quote, the National Commissioner of Police and deputies should be appointed by the President on a competitive basis. A selection panel established by the President should select and interview candidates for this post against objective criteria. The President should appoint the National Commissioner of Deputies from recommendations and reports received from this selection panel. This will enhance the incumbents standing in the eyes of the community and increase the respect that accorded them by the peers and subordinates, close quote. There is no better time to action the spirit of NDP than now. The competitive element of the vision can only happen if the posts are advertised and interested candidates given an opportunity to compete with others. The time to advertise the National Commissioner's post is now. The absence of the law to guide our actions has inculcated confusion and unintended disregard protocol advocated by the standing orders and regulations in the service. We have seen a major general being appointed to act as national commissioner above 29 of his seniors. He had to be irregularly promoted to a rank that did not exist to enable him to command his seniors. We have seen divisional commissioners acting as national commissioners above their seniors, which are deputy national commissioners. You can imagine as to who must salute as the protocol dictates that subordinates must salute and take orders from their superiors. If the seniors salute and take orders from their subordinates, they shall have violated the oath that comes with the commission conferred by the President. If they refuse to take orders from a subordinate, they may be viewed by those who did the appointment as undermining their authority. We have seen such acting subordinates appointing their seniors and thereafter reverting to the junior positions and start taking instructions from their appointees. This undermines discipline invested in the service. This unhealthy state of affairs can be remedied by amending Section 6 of the Police Act to make similar provisions as Section 17C, A, 12A to E that guides appointments in the DPCI. Compliance with the Regulation 8 of the South African Police Service Regulation. The ranks in the subs are governed by the South African Police Service Regulation of 1964. These police regulations were amended several times in the past. Some ranks were created, abolished, recreated. It is important to know at any given time as to what the ranks are. Currently, we have an unpleasant state of affairs where some senior managers are called by the ranks that do not exist. We specifically refer to a rank of Lieutenant General. It existed in 1990. Amendment as a rank below the Deputy National Commissioner and was abolished in 1995. Police leadership have agreed in the Labour Court cases of the two recently discharged Deputy National Commissioner that such rank does not exist. This is a judgment that must be applied to all other ranks that are still called by that name. The current General Staff rank in order of precedence is approved by the Honorable Minister Nteko in regulations as amended in 2016 are the following. General appointed as National Commissioner. Lieutenant General, appointed as a Deputy National Commissioner. Lieutenant General, appointed as Divisional Commissioner. Lieutenant General, appointed as Regional Commissioner. Lieutenant General, appointed as Provincial Commissioner. And therefore, thereafter, a Major General. Members of this August House will recall concerns raised about the previous head of communication, General Solomon Mahale, who was called Lieutenant General. Until April this year, we had the National Head of DPCR and Deputy National Head of DPCR who answered to the rank of Lieutenant General. As the honorable members will observe, such ranks do not exist. It creates some problems in understanding seniority. There is neither a rank of a Lieutenant General appointed as National Head of DPCR, nor a Lieutenant General appointed as Deputy National Head of DPCR. The questions to be answered are, is the National Head of DPCR senior to the Deputy National Commissioner, Regional Commissioner, Divisional Commissioner or Provincial Commissioner? Precisely where does it fit in terms of seniority? These questions cannot be answered by the regulation. Although Regulation 8.2 can have some remedy for the National Commissioner in finding a home for a rank that does not exist, the same provision does not extend to the Minister, which complicates the situation in the DPCI. If there is a need to have a rank not listed in the list of ranks, the Minister should simply amend the regulations. The Minister can equally extend Regulations 8.2 to include the Minister in respect of DPCI. Until that is done, no one should be called a Lieutenant General other than what is listed in the regulations of now. Honorable Chair and Members, the ranks should never be taken for granted. In the case of the relieved National Head of the DPCR, he was a Major General. I'm referring to General Temel. He was a Major General all the time until he was addressed Lieutenant General after the appointment, which is not condoned by Parliament, by the way. Strangely, when the post was advertised, the rank associated with the position was never stated. We want to put it on record as well, Honorable Chief, that we wrote to the Minister, or the then Minister of Police, Honorable Nteko, to say that the advertisement in terms of the regulation should have st- stayed at the rank of the officer and in accordance with what is supposed to be done. We did not get any response from that. With the declaration of the nullity, which means as you were, and that is the language we use in the police, if they want to say go back to what, to the position you were, the officer resumes the rank of a major general with its package, with no additional benefits brought by the putative appointment. Where did the complications of the rank of the national head and deputy come to bear with the same rank that was never complicated in the era of Anwar Draman, the Lieutenant General Anwar Draman? The honorable members will recall that Section 17C2A of the Police Act, as amended by the South African Police Service Amendment Act 57 of 2008, provided that, and I quote, the directorate comprises the head of the directorate, who shall be a deputy national commissioner appointed by the minister in concurrence with the cabinet. Close quote. Section 17CA1 of the Police Act, as amended by the South African Police Service Amendment Act 10 of 2012, provides that, and you will see, you will hear the difference now here. And I quote, the minister with the concurrence of cabinet shall appoint a person who is a South African citizen, B, a fit and proper person with due regard to his or her experience, consciousness and integrity, to be entrusted with the responsibilities of the office concerned. As the national head of the directorate for a non-renewable fixed period of not shorter than 7 years and not exceeding 10 years. Something which we as a union are not happy about this, because we don't see any reason why an entity of SAP, which has got provisions when it comes to issues of the officers appointed in terms of contracts, and that contracts are 5 years, and some of the people who are doing performing the same work have to be given a contract of between 7 and 10 years. This current position is silent about the rank. When the Lieutenant General Draman, who was a Deputy National Commissioner in terms of this regulation 2008 version, was relieved of his duties. The post was advertised without a rank coupled with it. When the appointment came, the incumbent is donning non-existent rank. The Police Act must state the ranks to be carried by the incumbent, which must be one of those approved by way of regulation. The ranks can probably be the DNC and divisional commissioners, respectively. If these ranks are not intended, then the regulations must be amended to make provisions for such ranks. Before the post is to be filled, a regulated rank must be stated upfront in an advertisement. Our submission in respect of the national head applies mutatis mutandis in respect of Section 17CA. 4, relating to deputy national head. Implementation of the National Development Plan. I took note of the comment which has been made by the Treasury as well, the Honorable Chair, when it comes to the issue of the realignment of new policy, the priorities, especially given to NDP. The NDP was adopted in South Africa in September 2012. It was after the appointment of the current national commissioner. Her term is expiring in June 2017. I'm referring to General Pieta. The question is the spirit of NDP going to be realized in selecting the next national commissioner of police? If that is not so, where must the fingers be pointed to? We are of view that this August House should guide the process and avoid misdirection. The failure to have a mechanism is not restricted to the National Commissioner, but to deputies too. This August House is a way that a post of a Deputy National Commissioner, crime detection, I'm referring to Lieutenant General Munduli, has been vacant since 2015. It is a critical vacant and funded post. No, not crime detection, sorry about that. We are of the, not crime intelligence, sorry, we are of the view that this should not be allowed to happen as the delivery of service is affected. Corruption cases. De Kock, who was sitting in prison, once said the following, I am not the only thug evil in jail. There are many thug evils that are walking the streets of South Africa. We haven't asked him a question as to why did he raise this question. Last year, we reported to this August House that there are 15 cases that have been swept under the carpet. The cases relate to 15 convicts who misrepresented their criminal convictions and got appointed in a sub or position. This is fraud, perjury, and contraventions of Section 682 of the Police Act. Instead of discharging them for this dishonesty, management condoned criminal convictions and kept them. In condoning the behavior, management stated, and I quote, condonation is recommended as these members were enlisted on the dates as indicated next to their names, and it was only determined that they have previous convictions after enlistment. It is, however, recommended that crime intelligence should first determine and follow the correct procedures before enlisting covert employees, close quote. You know, when intelligence officers, especially those that are doing covert, we normally don't utilize their names. We utilize code names. But nothing stops those people from undergoing a process of vetting them, so that we know exactly what is it that they have done before they get into the system. That's one thing. The second thing is that you also have to declare, you have to declare that there are no criminal cases pending against you when you get into the system, regardless of the other provisions that are there, which determine what kind of a person are you when you get into the system. I wonder if this appointment was not deliberate. Because even the response to it, regardless of all of these problems, they still went ahead and condoned their appointment. This precedent should not be allowed to prevail. And I will say this, Honorable Chair, why? If you look at the history of Eugene De Kock and his team, you will realize that he has been given almost everything that he needed to carry out atrocities amongst the citizenry of this country. He has been given cars to go, new vehicle, to go and do some dubious things in one province, and when he's back on his way, and his team, they have to destroy those resources. To entrust state resources on one person and one person only, it's very, very dangerous. And we need to start to regulate this kind of a relationship, Honorable Chair. This anomaly is now captured in a broadly published book by Major General Buiza. We regret to repeat this statement as the matter remains under the carpet. We have 15 convicts that are not redressed. They have committed deeds of dishonesty. We expected that when the senior management detected their dishonesty, they will not unlawfully condone their criminality. Regardless of condonations that allow convicts to remain in the police, the criminal cases that were already opened cannot be swept under the carpet by the SAPS leadership. We believe that IPID should take these cases and process them, as the SAPS has not shown interest since January 2011. It may also be proper to visit those who may have attempted to defeat the ends of justice. These cases cannot be in the hands of a captain And I'll quote his name this time. I refused to do it last time. I'll do it today for record purposes. That Captain Halal at national office is sitting with these matters. For in case the honorable members have got keen interest in this, so that they can ask him to provide feedback on these matters that we are referring to. This captain is not being supported, and on the other hand, they are...
President, Honorable Bachi, just want the name again of the captain. The
Captain Haralal.
Haralal. Thank you. You can proceed. Thank you.
Falsely reported to this August House, and you'll see this number here. Falsely reported, these are officials now of the state, the police. Falsely reported to this August House as having been closed. Those matters that we are referring to, 15 of them. We call upon this August House to ensure that the IP take over that responsibility. May we remind this August House that an answer to Parliament question number N, November Whiskey, NW, that's what I'm saying, November Whiskey, 111, dated 29 February 2016. It's a misrepresentation of the truth. I think what management did here, they went and took the answer given to this house as given to them by the current National Commission, not acting, but the current National Commissioner of the Police, General Peter Yero. They must go and check on these matters. They are not closed and they cannot be traced. They are not at the police station. If a docket has been opened as Kempton Park case 15 of 6, 2013, if we go to a police station, we must go and track down that docket. If we cannot find that docket, the procedure is that you put in a document which indicates who has removed that docket and for what. That piece of paper will remain in that space up until that investigation has been completed, and it will give all the particulars of that police officer who have taken that document. Those cases were not closed as false, as insinuated in the answer. They are not closed. IPID can easily interview the investigator, the one that we have quoted his name here, and obtain the documents because they are there. Finally, there are unreasonable delays in finalizing cases. I think this is also going to respond to some of the issues Treasury have raised today on the issue of the compensation of employees. There are unreasonable delays in finalizing cases against senior officers. Most of them are closer to retirement, and it will appear that the cases are deliberately delayed, allowing the retirement to set in. In this regard, there are cases of General Piega. We know that there's a process in there. General McKenna, General Munduli. When last did we really heard of General Munduli being in an office? A suspension which has never... This case of General Munduli is historic. I think it will be documented in the history of our establishment, because it has never happened that an officer stays out of office for such a long time. General Makhale, and that are moving at a snail pace. Junior officers are treated harsher as compared to senior management. The other thing that we want to bring, which I did not capture it in this, is the issue of the appointment. Now, looking at the issue of the compensation of employees, the appointment of lieutenant generals, which when General Pasani came in, that structure became so big. And that has increased. It could have played a part in the increase on the compensation of employees. Then we have got the issue of the external appointment. External appointments must be exercised with caution. We have agreed that external appointments, especially utilizing for Section 45 as well, which is the prerogative of the National Commissioner to appoint people with or without qualification. That provision needs to be looked at very carefully, because we have agreed as Labour as well that people whom the police are unable to produce, you may look at this external appointment. But if you want to promote people, you need to look first in the within the establishment. Because in the establishment, the national instructions, because we don't have the promotion policy, the national instructions will say that under no circumstances shall a member jump a rank. That was established to control the issue of compensation of employees. Because the difference between me and my next colleague will not be this big, but very small. Then we have got the issue of rank translation. When you translate a rank, and you've got a very small employee who is now going to fill in a position, a senior position, then the gap between a senior officer that the junior officer is going to fill is huge, which means that you will need to have more money to cover up on all of those issues. And we strongly believe that this thing, if management were to be asked really to have a relook at these issues, it can help a lot on the issues of COOs. The other thing that is worrying us is the issue of 10111 centers. At some stage it was in the media. The 10111 centers were appointed civilians to be call dispatchers and call takers. Those members, the law says they are not rendering an essential service. And at any given time, those members are entitled to go on strike. We as the South African Policing Union have said that anybody that renders any work within the police, in the special 10111 center, those people are rendering an essential service. Because if you were to ground down or close down that environment, then the police will be without eyes and ears on the ground. You won't be able to dispatch a vehicle to go and attend to a crime scene. And with the threats that the current management were exposed to, what we see management doing there is to try and want to remove all of those members and replace them with police officials. It's a good thing. But I don't think that is the way of addressing labor-related matters. I don't think that is the correct way of addressing those issues. And then we've got the issue of Ortea. We are aware of what happened at Oakham recently. The case that has been opened about the robbery that took place there and all that. Honorable Chair, I don't see any reason why would the management of the police put the entire 800 staff of OR Tambo on transfer because of the case that has been opened down there, and with no reason at all as to why they should line up all of those members, put them out of that environment. After some of these members have indicated, and there are case numbers indicated where they are saying there is a lot of irregular things that are taking place at OR Tambo, which senior management of the police did not do anything about it. These transfers are illegal because they don't form part of the provisos or provisions that are labeled in terms of the transfer policy, which is the movement of police officials from one place to another. It is not in the best interest of the service, and it is also not initiated by the members themselves. We want you, as honorable members, to have a look at these issues because they really create tension where it is not supposed to be there. I don't see reason why we should. And as we speak now, we went to court on this matter. This thing, I think there is a moratorium put on this thing, and the matter is going to be discussed further on the 18th of May 2017. It is an unpleasant situation. To cast aspersions on people and create a perception that the whole people that are sitting in this house, they are not honorable, they are not good, they are bad people without any reason. I think that should not be condoned. Honorable Chair, Parliament, we spoke about it here, is a defined benefit. Parliament exercise monopoly in providing medical aid within the police, and its sole mandate is to ensure that we have got a healthy police force. We said this from 2012 up until today. Do you know that Parliament has been found to be wanting by the Registrar of Medical Aid Scheme after we have lodged serious complaints about the way they have the Board of Trustees and executives have been handling the fund of Parliament. On the 26th of this month, of April, they had an acting AGM in Mpumalanga. There's a special one, a special AGM, to give feedback as directed by the Registrar of Medical Aid Scheme. And when they arrived there, the members went berserk about it because they wanted the full report as to what has happened to those people who are found to have misused the funds of the money of the fund. And that meeting did not go well. So far, that meeting, as far as we understand, is that a curator need to be found and facilitate the process up until we get leadership in that environment so that more Parliament can work.
Maybe just on that issue, we're going to have a hearing on Parliament, I think, in 4 weeks' time. So, I mean, you're also welcome to give us a presentation on that. If you maybe just can round up in the next 5 minutes, I just want to give Mr. Elder de Klerk also an opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Well, I think that was the last one. And we also want to encourage the ministry, if the Minister of Police really, we have had a meeting with him, we've got a very good relationship with him, I must say this. Most of the things that we see happening here is trying to address most of the issues which we raised. But the relationship between amongst his units, the heads of the HOPS, the heads of SAPS, the heads of IPED, that really is not doing any good to the image of the South African Police Service. And if he can work very hard in trying to address those issues. In short, this is our presentation to you. We thank you.
Thank you very much for your presentation. We appreciate it. I think there's a lot of Program 1 issues, and we're going to start with Program 1 this afternoon. So members, don't say you don't have got the material for questions. We're going to give Mr. Elder de Klerk the last presenter, who's a specialist on policing matters, to give his input, and then we'll allow questions just until before 1, because we must start 1 o'clock with the SAPS briefing. Mr. de Klerk, you're welcome.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Honourable Members, and the members of SAPU and the guests and media. And thank you to the Treasury input and also the input from SAPU, because it broadly set the scene for what I'm going to talk about. And critically for me is this idea of how do we ensure something that's already been mentioned, that the budget spend actually aligns with what we expect from the police, their performance, their impact, and the results they achieve. And one of the critical things we've already noticed is the very structure of police, and that we're spending more on police members and compensation than we're actually spending on what we can call the public business of the police. So that's broadly as kind of the issues that I want to address. And in line with that, I think I want to make the following assertions. One, that the South African police, it's a public service undertaking a public enterprise. They're not a business. And I think one of the critical things that have happened in the last 10 years or so is that we've seen a shift within the police to too many MBAs and less police officers, professional police officers. And what I mean by that is that the impact, the very nature of how the police is run, has created this idea that they're a secret society that only they can understand how the business of policing is. And I see members here who publicly understand differently, who probably were in the police, and would have a different view of how the police should be run. If they are a public service undertaking a public enterprise, then they're publicly accountable for how they spend their budget. So that's the first assertion I want to make. And in line with that is that if they claim that one of their key indicators is that they be a collaborative, consultative service, then why don't consult and collaborate on the budget? We've already heard this morning that the nature of the depth of the budget is not deep enough for us to make a true assessment of whether we're getting, what was it, bang for our buck, so to speak. So that's the first explanatory note that I want to say. The second one is that we have to undertake, and Treasury already admits, that we're working in an era of fiscal constraints and austerity. We're not going to get bigger budgets. That's just simple. That's a broad based international reality that we face it. So we have to spend smartly, and we have to spend wisely, and we have to spend with very clear goals and outcomes in mind, and we should be judged on whether our spending actually achieves our outcomes, our envisaged outcomes. We've also heard today that the South African Police Service is one of the few departments that seem to spend 100% or very close to 100% of their budget. That somehow their budget variance and wasteful expenditure and the like, we don't know how they're able to do so. So it's hard to know where there's been fiscal dumping. It's just impossible to know. You can't tell. And that's also irregular. I've served in and consulted to and worked as either a Commonwealth advisor or UN advisor in a number of police services around the world. No police service spend 100% of their budget. They can't. They're not that kind of. They're a lot more fluid, a lot more dynamic, and their budgets are things that are always questionable. And I find it phenomenal that the South African Police Service is able to spend 100% of their budget, or very close to. What we don't know from the police, we haven't seen a clear articulation of what they actually want to achieve by their budgets. Quantitative decreases in crime is no indicator of how the budget is actually spent. Especially if we can say that within the last three budget cycles, they actually haven't spent, well, let's say they have spent 100% of their budget and not achieved the stated outcomes, the quantitative stated outcomes, reductions in crime and the like. And I'll say something about that in a couple of minutes, this notion of crime combating, crime fighting, and whether that's in fact the so-called business of police, and how maybe we can do something different with the budget. And Chair and members, what we haven't seen from SAPS is a plan in support, a budget plan in support of the realization of their aims. We haven't seen it. There's no plan. This is our budget. These are the indicators. But we don't have a plan as to how to go from the budget to the achievement of the indicators. And I hope that the committee would ask for that. So we can go on to the next slide. So those are my just broad opening remarks and by explanation. So when I look at the police budget as an expenditure analysis, I consider the following points. The whole implementation of the back to basic approach, and I'll say something briefly about that. The strategic management cycle, and we've heard a lot from SAPU and Treasury in terms of management and where the police are at and how they're seeking to transform. The police's own stated goals and the NDP, the National Development Plan, the professionalized and demilitarization of police, and whether the budget spent for the next cycle is going to help us get there, to have a competency-based professional police that actually is publicly accountable. We need to look at the strategic direction as articulated by the police themselves, and whether that is actually going to align with budget and the budget spend aligns with it. We've looked at compensation liability. I won't say a lot about that, but I will just highlight in graphic form the issues and what it costs of police brutality in criminal cases of police, civil claims against police, the drop in public satisfaction in the last number of years, and the arrests and case finalization, because there's a lot of emphasis on spend on detective services in addition to visible policing. And picking one contact or one set of contact crime, murder and robbery trends, and actually find whether these things that scare our public most, whether the budget actually allows for us to address those fears and concerns that the public have. And then the public governance of the police, because the budget spend is part of the governance of the police, both the executive, by the executive, and by very central to this is the role of this committee. So that's kind of where I want to go, and I just want to make some points around that, and then I'm happy to take questions. Okay, the SAP's back to basic approach there. The chair, the committee and the chair, you're welcome to read all of that. All I want to say about this is that the assumption is that whatever was held in the past, and as a student of policing, the first thing I was told about post-colonial policing is that at some point in our trajectory, we're going to have this romance about the past. And I think we've got there with our democracy. There's this idea that things of the past was better. Well, it wasn't. The nature of the South African police force back then, wherever the back to basics extend to, surely cannot meet the demands of the 21st century. It cannot. When you have police members who don't know how to switch on a computer, we have police members without a driving license, when you have a completely paper-based community service center, you couldn't even begin to address the kind of information overload that 21st century policing setup demands from you. You couldn't do the kind of analysis, you couldn't do the kind of trend and trajectory, and you definitely don't have the levels of skills. So how does our budget respond and our budget spend begin to look at the challenge of 21st century policing? Issues of cybercrime, issues of immigration, movement of people. We had a huge concern when we had our elections with the fact that we needed to set an address for every voter. Yet our police is responding to an address when they respond to a service call. Where is the professional police officer that is able to facilitate, together with other departments, making sure that at least at the local level, our chair, municipal policing in particular, and the role of municipalities and its community service plan to ensure that the regular movement of people is captured in a way that allows and facilitates policing and respond to services. Ambulance services, emergency services, law enforcement all suffer from the same thing. And where are our professional police officers who step up and take a leadership role in ensuring that they can respond to those kind of public demands? So my concluding remark around the back to basics, and I'm happy to spend time arguing this both on paper and in person, simply to ask that the SAP's annual performance plan, that if we look at the analysis of the challenges of our policing today, how does the intended budget spend address the intended outcomes of the so-called back to basics approach? And I can't see it. I really cannot see it. Members have already raise reservations about this, and I concur and completely agree with them, Chair, that I can't see that the budget spend and the envisaged programming actually line up. Public satisfaction with the police have decreased dramatically over the last number of years. The figures speak for themselves, and I'm indebted to my colleagues at other institutions like the ISS and the like for some of these figures. And shouldn't public satisfaction with an essential service like the police be an indicator about whether we're spending our budget wisely and whether the leadership in the police is actually addressing public concerns and fears? I would suggest it does. There's been a management restructuring in the police with a clear plan from the 1st of February 2016. And the outcome of this management restructuring is supposed to make sure that there's a heightened police visibility, that safety of public during crime-fighting operations are ensured, that improving detective work in crime scenes, and that there's ensuring accountability. I'll leave it to the police unions to speak to whether that has actually been achieved. All I can say, looking from where I am, is that the next set of figures show that in fact this restructuring comes a little too late. And if we don't watch it as clearly as the members already had asked, both of Treasury and of this committee, that the next cycle of budget expenditure doesn't repeat the patterns of the last 3 years. This is a bit small, but it's taken directly from the 9 points back to basics SAP's strategic direction. And they make 9 claims that SAP wants to achieve. One, enhance police visibility. And unfortunately, police visibility is seen as roving patrols of police officers stuck in cars that are uncomfortable, unsafe, not agile, not flexible, and actually not suited for the, in most of the environments in which they operate. And I bet if the committee does an audit together with Treasury of where all the vehicles are, how often they break down, how much it costs to maintain them, and how many members can actually utilize them on a daily basis, then we'll find that that's an unwise budget expenditure and that we will not achieve the so-called visibility. The difficulty is that if you do see members out of their vehicles, walking down the street, engaging the public, we probably get a bigger return on public satisfaction, public contact and consultation than we do with members sitting in a car. SAP's claims that they're back to basic in the strategic direction for the next fiscal year will be through a responsive investigation, and I note, of every crime. Well, this flies in the face of SAP's talking about priority crime investigation and whether types of crimes are satisfied. You go to a community service center and you get asked, are you reporting this for insurance purposes, or are you importing it because you want us to investigate it? Well, I'm sorry, I'm a member of the public. I'm actually reporting this because firstly, you need to know about it. Two, I expect you to do something about it. And thirdly, I may or may not have insurance. So where do we get to begin to say that our budget spend actually relates to the reporting of and the investigation, and thorough investigation, of every single crime? Effective utilization of resources in support of the investigation of crime, well, that speaks for itself. I won't say much about that. I want to say something about crime intelligence. The former Minister of Police, Nazim Tetla, has already identified that crime intelligence is probably the weakest part of our policing setup. And what effectively we have is the collation of information and a lack of complete analysis of that information. I, in my wisdom, train crime intelligence officers, and now I'm talking out of the house and I'm talking about SAPS members, and they cannot even write a proper analysis. And it's no fault of theirs. It's a leadership, management, supervisory role that needs to train and ensure that the placement of members is actually based on competency. And if they don't have the competency chair, they'd be trained accordingly. So where in this budget does it show that our deficit in crime intelligence is actually going to be covered and corrected by this next budget cycle? Let's move on to the next one. SAP's arrest and NPA case finalization trends, well, yeah. We arrest before the fact. We charge for resisting arrests, which ups civil claims against our police officers, and we finalize even fewer cases. And you can see the figures. Our arrest is in the thousands, our finalizations is in the 31%, if not less. So how is the budget spend actually going to ensure that we don't arrest early, that we arrest on the basis of evidence, that we manage our crime scenes without compromising them, and that we, at the end of the day, don't have to unduly compensate people for unlawful arrest? We have to address these issues, because this is where most of our money goes, unfortunately. And it takes away from a budget that should be skewed differently. Murder and robbery trends. Well, these are some of the biggest contact crimes that our citizens are concerned about. SAPS's analysis or SAPS's indicators are often qualitative. And what we find is that they're not reaching their targets. Well, I want to say that perhaps we'd stop fighting crime. If this is the kind of outcome that we're going to have. What I mean by that is that a professional police officer understands the issues of risk, threat, harm, and vulnerability. I question my police colleagues about how do they actually determine who's at risk in our community, what are they at risk of, what threats they face, and how do I, as a policing professional, manage those risks, threats, harms, and vulnerability. Because crime comes from these things. Crime is not, there's no such, we have criminalized certain activities. Like if I murder you, that's called a crime. If I steal from you, it's called robbery or theft. But most of the things that we face actually speak directly to the fact that we are in harm's way when we do certain things. When I step outside my house, when somebody goes to a contact point, like an ATM, or gets onto a public transport late at night. So how do I determine what risk, threats, harms, and vulnerability our citizens are exposed to and begin to manage that in concord with them so that I can reduce the overall level of contact crimes so that police are not in a position to say, there's nothing I can do about this. Domestic violence legislation, kids at harm and risk. Sadly, Chair and committee members, what we see when we look at crime analysis and trends and the planning of the police and their budget spend, they talk about reactive and proactive intelligence, but they actually don't talk about their constitutional obligation to seek to prevent crime. And the only way to prevent crime is to understand risk, threats, harms, and vulnerabilities. Because then you can begin to understand how a commuter, the elderly, children, schools, malls are criminogenic entities and how to begin to address the threats against it and the risk that it exposes our citizens to. Police brutality in criminal cases, well, we spend way too much money on that. Let's just understand that. So when we talk about professional police officers and we talk about the integrity and credibility of the police, the training of the police and the use and the unregulated use of force, we have to unfortunately put this at their commanders, their supervisors and their leaders. But we have to put it to ourselves because we're not asking the right questions. And today we may not have the time to go through what are the right questions we should be asking. We should be asking a different set of questions. Police conduct and civil claims, there's a note, and I'm happy to give the committee on this, about why that's going up and how we should be addressing that. But it is going up, and a large part of the budget is actually compensating for an increase in claims against the police, whereas we should be working to decrease claims against the police, and a lot of those can actually be done a lot easier than just getting a bigger budget to allow for it. We have to request from the police, and we have to demand from them that they seek to decrease that and not just simply increase the budget to allow for an increase of this, as that's been the trend in the last couple of years. Finally, around the public governance of the police, from the appointment process as articulated by SAPU, but also from the constitutional imperatives that the Minister of Police gives direction and guidance to the South African Police Service, the accountable and oversight role of this body, the Treasury, IPED and others, and the Civilian Secretariat. It's critical that we have an engagement with police performance and engage in police with police budget spend much more regularly and much more deeper and thoroughly than we do. And I may be support of this ministerial dashboard that has already been proposed by one of the honourable members, that the minister and the committee takes regular input from the police as to whether their budget has been spent in line with their budget outcomes. Yeah. I think that's it.
Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you, Chair.
For your input, we appreciate it. I think it is very valuable for our interaction for the next few days. I'm going to ask our contact advisor just to quickly run through the focus areas from his perspective.
Yes, Chair. Honourable Chair, if I can still easier. Chair, thank you, Chair. I won't talk too much about the 2017-18 SAS plan, annual performance plan, because of our time, but I thought it's important for the committee just to note a couple of important issues. It's the penultimate year in delivery of the 2014-2019 SAS plan and medium-term strategic framework. So the goals has to be achieved by 2019-2020. Again, the NDP remains the cornerstone of government policy with respect to SAPs, especially Chapter 12 of the NDP with respect to safer communities. Again, the emphasis there on professionalism and demilitarization of the SAPs. Also very, very important is it calls for the development of a National Police Board, which is an important milestone. It's yet to be achieved. There's nothing in the APP about the National Police Board, for instance. It's important to keep SAPs out of the political terrain and for SAPs to remain professional as an institution. So some of the language in the APP was a bit worrying because it speaks about dissent. One associates dissent with ideologically a particular perspective. The police ought to remain neutral. Highlights of the 2017-18 APP. Over the medium term, the budget moves from 87.25 billion in 2017-18, 92.74 billion in 2018-19, and to 98.45 billion in 2019-20. Again, people have raised this, the back to basics approach is at the center of achieving the NDP and the medium-term strategic framework, and I just note the following: the focus on enhanced police visibility, thorough and responsive investigation of crime, efficient utilization of resources in the investigation of crime, and the collaborative, consultative approach to policing. That's stated in the APP, Chair, apart from the other five. But the concerns for the committee ought to look at, which the committee has been raised over the last six months, is leadership ethics and integrity. The committee has requested declarations from the SAPs. It has not received those declarations. All the senior managers ought to make declarations on an annual basis. The command and control of stations and the cluster management is a problem that's been raised in almost every meeting of the committee. Issues around cooperation with IPET and the civilian secretariat with respect to policies in relation to domestic violence and whether in fact those reports are being dealt with timelessly, and that for instance, if you take the investigation of the Marikana, SAPS reported in the last meeting that we had that they found nobody guilty in their internal hearings. So one ought to look at how SAPS applies the disciplinary measures correctly. There's been the APPs in some cases has not been aligned to the medium-term strategic framework targets. And if you look at the document that the researcher and Colette has pulled together, Chair, then one can look at specifically where that particularly is. So the committee ought to just be mindful of that. One of the areas which the committee has found on its oversight visits is that some stations, they have two informers. They've not been recruiting informers at some of the stations, and it's something that the committee ought to note as far as crime intelligence is concerned. A big issue is the accommodation of protection and security services. That Kimberley, the Free State building is falling apart, and still there's no real progress on the accommodation of the protection and security services. There's the issue of vetting of PPS members, and with in fact all of them have been vetted. Another issue that's come up in the public domain was the protection afforded to the former head of the AU, and whether in fact that necessitated the presidential protection for the former head of state. The former head of the AP, AU. See, other concerns is the detectives, the tools of trade, the ratio of vehicles to detectives has been raised several times in the committee. The details of the detective turnaround plan should be made clearer. One of the issues and recommendations that the committee has made is that they recruit former detectives. Police have given us a report, a preliminary report on how they've recruited, I think, 500 individuals, but they have not told us where they've placed them and so forth. So that those details must be made clearer. For visible policing, the role and training of particularly the cluster commander's chair is something that the committee has focused on. As far as border policing is concerned, the participation in the border management agency should be clarified. In the APP, the SAPS does talk about the collaboration with other agencies in the border management agency, but they haven't clarified that to this committee. The resurgence in trio crimes and the public confidence in SAPS, people have already raised that, and the victims of crime survey, because that's the final outcome. And then the leadership of the crime intelligence division. Other concerns, the DPCI leadership impasse, the status of killings in KwaZulu-Natal, and the status and progress of the new illegal firearms control unit and the SA Narcotics Enforcement Bureau. Again, the national priority offences and what constitutes national priority offences. The committee also have raised the issue of the wellness of the members of SAPS and how they're being dealt with. One of the areas that's almost fallen off the table is the issue around the reservist recruitment and the operations. SAPS have advertised for reservists, but the committee hasn't heard much as to what has happened since. Chair, the status of legislation coming to the committee, because we have to make proper preparations for that legislation. The status of crime prevention, there's been a move, or in the APP, the SAPS is saying they ought to move towards crime prevention. We're talking about crime reduction, but if we talk about crime prevention, it ought to be cheaper because you're preventing the cases, but we don't have the details around that. Ultimately, the committee ought to look at the crime indicators, and there has to be a movement from the way SAPS allocates crime indicators to what are the outcomes of the actions. Because if you remember the oversight visit, the study tour that we had to the UK, they were big on the outcomes of actions of the police rather than the indicators itself. There has to be a reduction in the numbers of crime committed with a focus on prevention. And there has been several changes in some of the indicators in the APP from last year, Chair. And again, the issue around the alignment of targets in the APP to the medium-term strategic framework. I think it's on page 20-something that the police make this particular indication of the alignment of targets, where they haven't aligned such targets with the medium-term strategic framework. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Irvin. Thank you for those presentations. Members, I think we note the information that was given to us. I just want to take a 10-minute break before we're starting at 1 o'clock with SAP, so a 10-minute break. Thank you very much.
Thank you.